What is to be done? Burning questions of our movement, by N. Lenin. The epigraph here, struggle within the party gives the party strength and vitality. The greatest sign of weakness of the party is vagueness and the blunting of sharply drawn boundaries. The party is strengthened when it purifies itself. From a letter of LaSalle to Marx, 24th of June, 1852. Forward. According to the original plan of the author, the present pamphlet would have been dedicated to a detailed development of the ideas set forth in the article Where to Begin, Iskra No. 4, May 1901. And first of all, we have to apologize to the reader for the tardy fulfillment of the promise given there and repeated in response to many private inquiries and letters. One of the reasons for the delay was the attempt to unify all the émigré social democratic organizations undertaken in July of the previous year, that is 1901. It was natural to wait for the results of this attempt, since if it had succeeded, then perhaps it would have been necessary to set out the organizational views of Iskra from a somewhat different point of view. In any event, a success would have promised a very quick end to the existence of two tendencies in Russian social democracy. As the reader knows, the attempt ended in failure. As we will try to show later, it could not have ended otherwise, given the new turn in number 10 of Rabochi Dielo toward economism. It turned out to be absolutely necessary to commence a decisive struggle with this tendency that is diffuse and indeterminate, but is all the more tenacious and capable of reviving in various forms. Accordingly, the original plan of the pamphlet changed and broadened very significantly. The main theme of the pamphlet was supposed to be the three questions set forth in the article Where to Begin, namely, the character and main content of our political agitation, our organizational tasks, and the plan for building a militant all-Russian organization simultaneously and from different starting points. These questions have long interested the author, who already tried to raise them in Rabochaya Gazeta during one of the unsuccessful attempts at its resuscitation. But the original idea of limiting the pamphlet to an analysis of only these three questions and to set out my views as far as possible in a positive form, without or almost without resorting to polemics, has proved completely unrealizable for two reasons. On the one hand, economism has shown itself to be much more vital than we had supposed. We use the word economism in the broad sense explained in Iskra, No. 12, December 1901, in the article A Conversation with Defenders of Economism, an article which is, so to speak, an outline of the book now presented to the reader. It became very clear that the different views on these three questions were explained by a radical opposition of the two tendencies in Russian social democracy to a much greater degree than by disagreements over details. On the other hand, the inability of the economists to understand the views set forth in Iskra demonstrated clearly that we are often talking literally in different languages, and that for this reason we cannot arrive at any sort of agreement if we do not begin ab ovo, from the egg. This makes it necessary to undertake a systematic explanation in as popular a form as possible, illustrated with a great many concrete examples of all the underlying points of our differences. And I decided to try such an explanation, completely aware that it would severely extend the dimensions of the book and slow down its publication, but seeing no other way to fulfill the promise I made in the article Where to Begin. I must therefore add to my apology about the tardiness of the pamphlet, an apology about the many inadequacies in its literary presentation. I was forced to work at the highest possible speed, along with interruptions from all other sorts of work. The analysis of the three questions mentioned above remains, as before, the main theme of the pamphlet, but I had to begin with two or more general questions. First, why has such an innocent and natural slogan as freedom of criticism become such a red flag for us? Second, why cannot we come to an understanding with each other about even the basic question of the role of social democracy in relation to the Stikhini massed movement? Stikhini means elemental, grassroots, or spontaneous. Furthermore, an exposition of our views about the character and content of political agitation turned into an explanation of the differences between trade unionist, that is a loan word of the English word trade unionist, and social democratic politics. An exposition of our views on the organizational tasks turned into an explanation of the differences between the artisanal limitations that satisfy the economists and what we believe to be the necessary organization of revolutionaries. I also insist all the more on the plan for an all-Russian political newspaper because the objections made against it are so baseless and respond so little, in essence, to the question posed in the article, Where to Begin, about starting simultaneously and from all points. Finally, in a concluding part of the pamphlet, I hope to show that we did all that lay within our power to ward off a decisive break with the economists, a break that was nevertheless inevitable. Rabotchi Dielo acquired, if you wish, the historic significance of revealing so fully and so vividly not economism in a straightforward and logical form, but the confusion and the unsteadiness that constituted the defining trait of a whole period in the history of Russian social democracy, and therefore what may seem at first glance as an excessively detailed polemic with Rabotchi Dielo also acquires some significance, since we cannot go forward if we do not liquidate this period once and for all. February 1902 and Lenin. Chapter 1. Dogmatism and, quote, freedom of criticism. A. What does freedom of criticism mean? Freedom of criticism, this is undoubtedly the most fashionable slogan of the present time, used most often in the disputes among socialists and democrats of all countries. At first glance, it is difficult to imagine anything stranger than these solemn appeals of one of the disputing parties to freedom of criticism. Are their voices really raised in the ranks of the advanced parties against the constitutional law of the majority of European countries that guarantees freedom of science and scientific investigation? Something's not right here. Any person looking at this dispute from the side must be saying to himself when he hears this fashionable slogan repeated at every turn. But before he has penetrated into the essence of the disagreements between the disputing parties, this slogan evidently is one of those catchwords that are sanctified by use, like nicknames, and have become a normal vocabulary item. Indeed, it is not a secret to anyone that in contemporary international social democracy, two tendencies have formed. Now we have a footnote. Incidentally, in the history of recent socialism, there is a close to unique and in its way comforting phenomenon. The disputes between various tendencies within socialism have been transformed from national ones to international ones. In earlier times, the disputes between LaSallians and Eisenachers, between Guestists and Possibilists, between Fabians and Social Democrats, between those loyal to Narodnaya Volia and Russian Social Democrats, have all remained purely national disputes that reflected purely national peculiarities and took place, as it were, on different levels. In the present time, as is now perfectly clear, the English Fabians, the French ministerialists, the German Bernsteinians, the Russian critics are all one family. They all praise one another, teach one another, and conduct a war together against dogmatic Marxism. Perhaps in this first international skirmish with socialist opportunism, international revolutionary social democracy will acquire strength sufficient to put a final end to the political reaction that has long reigned in Europe. And the footnote. So indeed, it is not a secret to anyone that in contemporary international social democracy, two tendencies have formed. Here the struggle between them breaks out in a fierce flame, while there it subsides and smolders under the ashes of edifying resolutions of truce. The content of the new tendency, the one that regards old dogmatic Marxism critically, is defined with ample precision by what Bernstein says and what Millerand does. Social democracy must transform itself from a party of social revolution into a democratic party of social reform. Bernstein shored up this political demand with a whole battery of new arguments and considerations that were placed together in a rather impressive system. The possibility of giving socialism a scientific base and proving its necessity and inevitability on the basis of the materialist view of history was denied. The fact of growing poverty, proletarianization, and intensification of capitalist contradictions was denied. The very concept of a final aim was shown to be baseless, and the idea of the dictatorship of the proletariat was unconditionally rejected. The opposition in principle between liberalism and socialism was denied. The theory of class struggle, allegedly inapplicable in a strictly democratic society that is administered according to the will of the majority, was denied, and so forth. In this way, the demand for a decisive turn from revolutionary social democracy to bourgeois social reformism is accompanied by a no less decisive turn towards bourgeois criticism of all the fundamental ideas of Marxism. And since this bourgeois criticism has been conducted for a long time against Marxism from the political tribune as well as the university chair, in a mass of pamphlets and a whole series of scholarly treatises, since the whole new generation of the youth of the educated classes has been systematically brought up on this criticism over the course of decades, then it is unsurprising that the new critical tendency in social democracy emerged in no time at all as something completely finished, like Minerva from the head of Jupiter. As far as content is concerned, this tendency did not need to develop and take shape. It was transferred directly from bourgeois literature into socialist literature. Furthermore, if Bernstein's theoretical criticism and his political desires still remained unclear to anybody, then the French went to the trouble of providing an object lesson in the new method. France again justified its ancient reputation as, quote, the country in whose history the struggle of classes are brought to their full conclusion, Engels from the foreword to Marx's work, The 18th Brumaire. The French socialists do not theorize, but acted. The political conditions of France, more developed in a democratic sense, permitted them to move right away to practical Bernsteinism with all its consequences. Millerand gave an excellent example of this practical Bernsteinism. Not for nothing did Millerand throw himself with such zeal to defend and exalt both Bernstein and Vollmar. Indeed, if social democracy is in its essence nothing but a party of reform that should have the audacity to admit this openly, well then a socialist not only has the right to enter into a bourgeois government, but is even obligated to strive for this at all times. If democracy in its essence means the abolition of class dominance, well then why shouldn't a socialist minister charm the entire bourgeois world with speeches about class collaboration? Why shouldn't he stay in the ministry even after the murder of workers by the gendarmes showed for the 100th and 1,000th time the true character of the democratic collaboration of classes? Why shouldn't he personally participate in official greetings for the Tsar, for whom the French socialists have no other name than the hero of the gallows, Knout and Exile, Knouteur, Pendeur et Deportateur, Deporter? And the reward for this endlessly humiliating self-abasement of socialism before the whole world, for this leading astray of the socialist awareness of the worker masses, the sole foundation that can guarantee us victory. The reward for all this are some pompous proposals for some pitiful reforms, so pitiful that more has been won from bourgeois governments. Anyone who doesn't deliberately shut his eyes cannot help seeing that the new critical tendency in socialism is nothing other than a new variety of opportunism. And if one judges people not by the brilliant uniform that they themselves put on, not by the noisy nickname that they themselves have adopted, but by how they act and what they really propagandize, then it becomes clear that freedom of criticism is the freedom of the opportunist tendency in social democracy, the freedom to transform social democracy into a democratic party of reform, the freedom of instilling bourgeois ideas and bourgeois elements into socialism. Freedom is a glorious word, but the most predatory wars are conducted under the banner of freedom of industry, Under the banner of the freedom of labor, the laboring classes are looted. The same innate hypocrisy is found in the present-day use of the term freedom of criticism. People who are genuinely convinced that they are moving science forward do not demand freedom for the new views alongside of the old, but the replacement of the latter by the former. And the present-day shouting of long live freedom of criticism is too reminiscent of the fable of the empty barrel. We proceed in a closely knit group along a precipitous and difficult path, holding each other with a firm grip. We are surrounded by enemies on all sides, and almost always we must proceed under fire. We have joined together by a freely taken decision, precisely in order to fight with enemies and not to get stuck in the neighboring swamp, whose inhabitants have from the very beginning condemned us because we separated out into a special group and chose the path of struggle, rather than the path of conciliation. And now several of us take up the cry, "Let's go into the swamp!" And when people begin to scold them, they object, "Aren't you people backward, and aren't you ashamed to deny us our freedom, to urge you on to a better path?" Oh yes, gentlemen, you are free not only to urge, but to proceed wherever you want, even into the swamp. We even consider that your real place is precisely there, but we are ready to give all the assistance we can for your removal thither. Let's go there. But let go of our hands. Don't cling to us and don't disgrace the glorious word of freedom, because we also are free to proceed where we wish, free to fight not only against the swamp, but against those who turn us toward the swamp. B. New defenders of freedom of criticism. And now, just the other day, this very slogan, freedom of criticism, is solemnly advanced by Rabotchi Dielo, number 10, the organ of the emigre Union of Russian Social Democrats. It is advanced not as a theoretical postulate, but as a political demand, as an answer to the question, is it possible to unify the active social democratic organizations operating abroad? Rabotchi Dielo's answer is, freedom of criticism is necessary for a long-lasting unification, page 36. From this announcement comes two completely definite conclusions. One, Rabotchi Dielo has decided to defend the opportunist tendency in international social democracy. Two, Rabotchi Dielo demands freedom of opportunism in Russian social democracy. Let us examine these two conclusions. Rabotchi Dielo is not pleased in particular by, quote, the tendency of Iskra and Zarya to prophesy a break between the mountain and the Gironde of the international social democracy. In general, writes the editor of Rabotchi Dielo, B. Krichevsky, this talk of mountain and Gironde in the ranks of social democracy seems to us to be a superficial historical analogy, a strange one to see used by Marxists. The mountain and the Gironde did not represent differing temperaments or intellectual tendencies, as it might appear to an ideologue or historian, but different classes or strata, small artisans together with the proletariat on one side and the middle bourgeoisie on the other. Within the contemporary socialist movement, there is no clash between class interests. The entire movement, in all, B. Krichevsky's emphasis, all its varieties, including the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists, stands on the ground of the class interests of the proletariat, its class struggle for political and economic liberation. That's from pages 32 to 33. A courageous assertion. Hasn't B. Krichevsky heard of the fact pointed out long ago that it was precisely the widespread participation in the socialist movement in recent years of the stratum of educated people that assured such a rapid dissemination of Bernsteinism? And most importantly, on what does our author base his opinion that even, quote, the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists stand on the ground of the class struggle for the political and economic liberation of the proletariat? There is no way of telling. The resolute defense of the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists is shored up by absolutely no arguments or reasoning. The author evidently thinks that since he is repeating what even the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists say about themselves, why, then his assertion doesn't need proofs. But can we imagine anything more superficial than his judgment of an entire tendency on the basis of what this tendency says about itself? Can we imagine anything more superficial than the following story with a moral about the different and even diametrically opposed types or roads of party development? Rabotsi Dielo, pages 34 through 35. The German Social Democrats, don't you see, recognize full freedom of criticism. The French do not, and precisely their example shows all the, quote, harm of intolerance. Precisely the example used by B. Krzyzewski, we will answer, shows that some people who call themselves Marxists use history literally, quote, in the Ilovaisky style. In order to explain the unity of the German Socialist Party and the fragmentation of the French Socialist Party, we evidently don't need to delve into the particularities of the history of the two countries or compare militarist, semi-absolutist conditions with republican parliamentarism or analyze the consequences of the commune and the exceptional law against the socialists or compare economic life and economic development or recall that the unexampled growth of German social democracy was accompanied by an energy of struggle against errors not only theoretical, Mühlberger, Düring, socialists of the professorial chair, but also tactical, like LaSalle. Is an energy itself unexampled in the history of socialism, and so on and so forth. Nothing like this is necessary. The French fight among themselves because they are intolerant. The Germans are united because they are such nice people. And we have a footnote here on Düring. When Engels attacked Düring with such fervor, there were more than a few representatives of German social democracy who inclined to Düring's views, so that accusations of sharpness, intolerance, uncomradely polemics, and the like were showered on Engels even publicly at a party congress. At the 1877 congress, Most and his comrades submitted a resolution to remove Engels' articles from Vorwärts as presenting no interest for the great majority of readers, unquote. And Walteich announced that the publication of this article had brought him great harm to the party, that Düring had shown great services to social democracy. Quote, we should utilize everybody in the interests of the party, and if professors are disputing among themselves, Vorwärts is not the place to conduct such disputes. Vorwärts, 6th of June, 1877, number 65. As you can see, this is an example of the, quote, freedom of criticism, unquote, an example that our legally permitted critics and our illegal, or underground, opportunists, who love to point to the example of the Germans, would do well to reflect upon. Right, you think the Germans just have such nice people. And note that a fact that completely refutes the defense of the Bernsteinists is pushed aside by means of this inimitable profundity. Whether the Bernsteinists do actually stand on the ground of the class struggle of the proletariat is a question that can be decided finally and irrevocably only by historical experience. Therefore, it is precisely France that has much more significance in this connection, since it is the only country in which the Bernsteinists have tried to stand independently on their own feet, accompanied by the warm approval of their German colleagues, and partly also by Russian opportunists. Cf. Rabotsi Dielo, number 2-3, pages 83-84. The reference to the, quote, intolerance of the French, besides its, quote, historical, in the nosedrev sense, significance, turns out to be simply an attempt to cover up a most unpleasant fact with angry words. And we certainly don't intend to make a present of the Germans to B. Krzyzewski and the other multitudinous defenders of freedom of criticism. If, quote, the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists, unquote, are still tolerated in the ranks of the German party, then only to the extent that they subordinate themselves both to the Hanover Resolution, resolutely rejecting Bernstein's, quote, corrections, and the Lübeck Resolution that contains, despite its diplomatic nature, a direct warning to Bernstein. From the point of view of the interests of the German party, we can dispute whether diplomacy of this sort is appropriate here, whether in this case a bad peace is really better than a good quarrel. we can differ, in a word, in our evaluation of the expediency of this or that method of rejecting Bernsteinism, but we cannot deny the fact that the German party did reject Bernsteinism twice over. Therefore, to think that the German example confirms the thesis that, quote, the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists stand on the ground of the proletariat's class struggle for political and economic liberation, unquote, to think this is to completely misunderstand what is going on right before our eyes. We have a note. We should also note the fact that when discussing Bernsteinism in the German party, Rabotsi Diello always confines itself to a bare recital of the facts with a complete, quote, abstention from its own evaluation. See, for example, number 2-3, page 66 on the Stuttgart Congress. All differences are reduced to, quote, tactics, and all that is asserted is that the vast majority remained faithful to the previous revolutionary tactic. Or number 4 and 5, page 25 and following, a simple paraphrase of the speeches at Hanover, along with Babel's resolution, while an exposition and criticism of Bernstein is again, as in number 2-3, deferred to a, quote, special article. Curiously enough, on page 33 in number 4-5, we read, quote, the views set forth by Babel were supported by the vast majority of the Congress, unquote, and a little later, quote, David defended the views of Bernstein, who tried first of all to show that, after all is said and done, indeed that's what he said, Bernstein and his friends stand on the ground of the class struggle, unquote. This was written in December 1899, and in September 1901, Rabotsi Diello must have changed their minds about Babel's correctness, and now repeat the views of David as their own. Back to the main text. And that's not all. As we have already noted, Rabotsi Diello presents itself to Russian social democracy with its demand for, quote, freedom of criticism, and with its defense of Bernsteinism. It is evident that they have convinced themselves that among us, someone is unjustly insulting our, quote, critics and Bernsteinists. Which ones, precisely? By whom? Where? When? And why unjustly? Rabotsi Diello is silent on these questions and does not say a single word about a single Russian critic or Bernsteinist. We are left to draw one of two possible conclusions. Either the unjustly insulted party is none other than Rabotsi Diello itself. This is confirmed by the fact that both articles of issue number 10 talk only about insults delivered by Zarya and Iskra to Rabotsi Diello. Then how do you explain the oddity that Rabotsi Diello, so stubbornly denying any solidarity with Bernsteinism, cannot defend itself without blurting out some remark about, quote, the most dyed-in-the-wool Bernsteinists, and about freedom of criticism? And the other possibility, or some third parties have been unjustly insulted. Then what could be the motive for silence about them? We see in this way that Rabotsi Diello continues the game of hide-and-seek that it has indulged in, as we will show later, from its very origins. But for now, direct your attention to this first application in practice of the laudable, quote, freedom of criticism. In actual fact, it leads not only to the absence of any criticism, but even to the absence of any independent judgment whatsoever. The same Rabotsi Diello that remains silent about the secret sickness, to use Starover's very apt expression, of Russian Bernsteinism, proposes as a cure for this sickness nothing more than to copy the latest German prescription against the German variety of the disease. Instead of freedom of criticism, a slavish, worse, a simian imitation. The social and political content of present-day international opportunism is the same everywhere, but it appears in different varieties according to national peculiarities. In one country, a group of opportunists has stood for a long time under its own banner, the Fabians in England. In another, the opportunists spurn theory and carry out in practical terms the policy of those radicals who call themselves socialists, Millerand in France. In a third, we see a few members of the Revolutionary Party cross over to the camp of opportunism and try to attain their aims not by an open struggle for principles or for a new tactic, but by a gradual, unnoticed, and, if I may put it this way, unpunishable leading astray of their party. Bernstein in Germany. In a fourth, we see the same kind of renegades use these same methods in the shadows cast by political slavery, with a completely original combination of, quote, legal and, quote, illegal activity. Legally permitted Marxists and underground economists in Russia. And so on, right? To undertake to talk about freedom of criticism and of Bernsteinism as a condition for the unity of Russian social democrats, and at the same time not to take the trouble to analyze how exactly Russian Bernsteinism manifests itself and what fruit it has produced, why, this is to undertake to talk in order to not say anything. Let us ourselves try to say something, if only in a few words, about what Rabotsi Dielo doesn't want to say, or perhaps doesn't dare to understand. C. Criticism in Russia. The fundamental peculiarity of Russia in the present context is that the very beginning of the Stikhini worker movement, that's spontaneous, naturally rising to the surface worker movement, on one side, and the turn of advanced public opinion toward Marxism on the other, was marked by the merger of obviously heterogeneous elements under a common flag in order to conduct a struggle with the common opponent, an outmoded social-political worldview. We are speaking of the honeymoon period of, quote, legally permitted Marxism. This was, in general, a very unique phenomenon. Nobody in the 1880s or the beginning of the 1890s could even have believed in the very possibility of it. In an autocratic country where the press is fully enslaved, in an era of extreme political reaction that persecutes even the tiniest appearance of dissatisfaction and protest, the theory of revolutionary Marxism, set out in an Aesopian language that was completely understandable to all, quote, interested parties, suddenly finds itself a road into the censored press. The government was used to regarding the theory of revolutionary Narodnaya Voliaism as the only dangerous one, not noticing, as usual, its internal evolution toward moderation, and delighting in any criticism directed against it. Before the government got its bearings, and before the weighty army of censors and gendarmes recognized the new enemy and rushed to smash it, there passed a not inconsiderable, by our Russian standards, amount of time. And during this time, Marxist books appeared one after the other, Marxist journals and newspapers were started, literally everybody became Marxists. Marxists were flattered and courted. Publishers were delighted by the exceptionally brisk sale of Marxist books. It is completely understandable that among the novice Marxists who were surrounded by this incense, there appeared more than one, quote, writer who became full of himself, unquote. At present, we can speak of this period calmly as something in the past. It is no secret for anybody that the brief flowering of Marxism on the surface of our literature was called forth by an alliance between people with extreme views and people with very moderate views. In essence, the latter were bourgeois democrats, and this conclusion, confirmed to the point of obviousness by the later development of, quote, criticism, suggested itself to one or two people, even while the, quote, alliance was intact. But if that is the case, then doesn't the great responsibility for the following, quote, time of confusion, unquote, fall precisely on the revolutionary social democrats who entered into this alliance with future, quote, critics? This kind of question, together with an affirmative answer, is heard now and again from people who look at the matter in a very simplistic fashion. But these people are completely wrong. The only ones who fear temporary alliances, even with unreliable people, are those with no confidence in themselves, and not a single political party could exist without such alliances. But the merger with the legally permitted Marxists was, in its way, the first genuine political alliance of Russian social democracy. Thanks to this alliance, a strikingly quick victory was achieved over populism, as well as a huge dissemination of the ideas of Marxism, even though in a vulgarized form. Besides, the alliance was concluded not entirely without any, quote, conditions. The proof, Materials on the Question of the Economic Development of Russia, the Marxist collection burned in 1895 by the censor. If the agreement to publish, along with the legally permitted Marxists, can be compared to a political alliance, then this book can be compared to a political treaty. The break was caused, of course, not because the, quote, allies turned out to be bourgeois Democrats. On the contrary, the representatives of this tendency are the natural and desirable allies of social democracy insofar as its democratic tasks are concerned, tasks that are brought to the forefront by the present-day position of Russia. But a necessary condition of such an alliance is the full possibility for socialists to reveal to the worker class the hostile opposition between its interests and the interests of the bourgeoisie. But Bernsteinism and the, quote, critical tendency, to which a clear majority of the legally permitted Marxists belong, removed this possibility. They led socialist awareness astray, they vulgarized Marxism, preached a theory of the blunting of social contradictions, labeled the idea of social revolution and the dictatorship of the proletariat as absurd, reduced the worker movement and the class struggle to a narrow trade unionism, used as a loan word in Russian, right? This English word's used in Russian. Trade unionism and a realistic, quote, unquote, struggle for petty, gradual reforms. This is entirely equivalent to bourgeois democracy's negation of socialism's right to independence, and therefore its right to exist. It signifies in practice a striving to transform the worker movement that is now commencing into a tale of the liberals. Naturally, a break was inevitable under these conditions. But the, quote, unique particularity of Russia shows itself in this. The break meant a simple elimination of the Social Democrats from, quote, legally permitted literature of the kind most accessible to everybody and widely disseminated. In this literature were now entrenched the, quote, used-to-be Marxists, unquote, who arose, quote, under the sign of criticism, unquote, and received close to a monopoly of, quote, denunciation of Marxism. The slogans, quote, against orthodoxy and long live freedom of criticism, now repeated by Rabochi Dielo, immediately became fashionable catchwords. That censors and the gendarmes had no problems at all with this fashion is evident from such facts as the appearance of 3 Russian editions of the Book of the Notorious a la Herostratus, Bernstein, or the recommendation by Zubatov of the books of Bernstein, Prokopovich, and so on, Iskra number 10. On social democracy now lay the difficult task, a heavy one in and of itself, and made unbelievably more difficult by purely external obstacles, of a struggle with the new current of criticism. And this current did not confine itself to the literary arena. The turn toward, quote, quote, criticism was met by a corresponding infatuation with, quote, economism on the part of the praktiki of social democracy. The interesting issue of how the link and interdependence between legally permitted criticism and illegal, quote, economism originated and grew up could be the subject of a special article. For us, it is sufficient to note the undoubted existence of this link. The notorious credo acquired such well-deserved renown just for the reason that it openly formulated this link and blurted out the basic political tendency of, quote, economism. Have the workers carry out the economic struggle. To speak more precisely, the trade unionist struggle, for this struggle embraces a specific worker politics as well. And have the Marxist intellectuals fuse with the liberals for a political, quote, struggle. Trade unionist work among the people, unquote, would be the fulfillment of the first half of this task, and legal criticism the second half. This declaration was such an excellent weapon against, quote, economism, that if the credo didn't exist, it would be worth inventing it. The credo wasn't invented, but it was published without the knowledge, and perhaps even against the will, of its authors. At least, the writer of these lines, a participant in bringing the new, quote, program, to the light of God's world, had to hear complaints and reproaches that a brief summary of views thrown together by participants in a conversation was disseminated in copies, received the label credo, a creed, right, and was even printed along with a protest. We touch on this episode because it reveals a very curious trait of our economism, quote-unquote. Its fear of publicity, that word incidentally in Russian, glasnost. This is indeed a trait of, quote, economism in general. And not only the authors of the credo, it appears in Rabotchiya Musl, the most direct and open advocate of economism, and in Rabotchi Dielo, indignant about the publication of, quote, economist documents in Vademecum, and in the Kyiv Committee, that 2 years ago refused permission for the publication of its, quote, profession de foi, or profession of faith, right, along with a written refutation of it, note 4, and in many, many individual representatives of economism. So that note reads, as far as we know, the composition of the Kyiv Committee has changed since that time. So this fear of criticism manifested by the partisans of freedom of criticism cannot be explained only by cunning, although undoubtedly sometimes cunning is not absent. It would be unwise to expose the new and as yet weak growths of the new tendency to the attacks of opponents. No, the majority of, quote, economists are completely sincere when they regard, and by the very essence of economism, must regard, with disapproval any kind of theoretical disputes, factional disagreements, broad political questions, projects to organize the revolutionaries, and so forth. Quote, leave all that to the emigres, unquote. This is what one of the more thoroughgoing, quote, economists once said to me. And he expressed, in this way, a widely disseminated, but still purely trade unionist, view of things. Our business is the worker movement along with the worker organizations that are here in our locality. And as for the rest, it's all something made up by doctrinaires, a, quote, overvaluation of ideology, as the authors of the letter in number 12, Iskra, put it in unison with number 10, Rabotchi Dielo. Let us now ask ourselves, in view of these peculiarities of Russian, quote, criticism and Russian Bernsteinism, what should have been the task of those who wish to be opponents of opportunism in deed and not just in word? Firstly, it was imperative to take over the job of renewing theoretical work that had only just begun in the era of legally permitted Marxism, and that now fell again to the lot of illegal activists. The successful growth of the movement is impossible without such work. Secondly, it was necessary to come out actively in the struggle with the legally permitted, quote, criticism that so strongly leads people's outlook astray. Thirdly, it was imperative to come out actively against confusion and unsteadiness in the practical movement, exposing and refuting any attempts to consciously or unconsciously lower the level of our programs and our tactics. It is a well-known truth that Rabotchi Dielo did not do the first, nor the second, nor the third. And later on, we will have to explain this well-known truth in detail and from a number of angles. All I want to do now is show the glaring contradiction between the demand for, quote, freedom of criticism and the specific features of our own homegrown criticism and our Russian, quote, economism. And in this connection, look at the text of the resolution with which the, quote, Union of Russian Social Democrats Abroad, unquote, the parent organization of Rabotchi Dielo, endorsed the point of view of Rabotchi Dielo. In the interests of the further ideological development of social democracy, we see freedom of criticism in party literature to be unconditionally necessary, insofar as this criticism does not stand opposed to the class and revolutionary character of this theory. Two Congresses, page 10. The resolution is supported as follows. The resolution, quote, in its first half, coincides with the revolution of the Lübeck Party Congress of the SPD about Bernstein. In their charming naivete, the union people do not even notice what a testimonium paupertatis, proof of poverty, they provide for themselves by means of this copycatting. Back to the quote. But in the second half, we limit freedom of criticism more stringently than the Lübeck Party Congress, unquote. So the resolution of the union is directed against Russian Bernsteinists? Otherwise, it would be completely absurd to refer to Lübeck. But it is not true that the union resolution, quote, stringently limits freedom of criticism. The Germans, in their Hanover resolution, rejected point after point of precisely those revisions proposed by Bernstein, and the Lübeck resolution gave a warning to Bernstein in person, naming him in the resolution. Meanwhile, our, quote, free imitators do not mention in any way a single manifestation of specifically Russian, quote, criticism and Russian, quote, economism. Given this silence, the bare reference to the class and revolutionary character of theory leaves a very wide space open for misinterpretation, especially when the union refuses to categorize, quote, so-called economism, unquote, as opportunism. Two Congresses, page 8, remark on point 1. But this is only in passing. The main point is that the position of the opportunists, vis-à-vis the revolutionary social democrats, is entirely different in Russia and in Germany. In Germany, revolutionary social democrats stand, as we know, for the preservation of what exists. The old program and tactics that everybody knows and that have been worked out to the last detail by long decades of experience. The, quote, critics are the ones who want to introduce changes, and besides, since these critics are an insignificant minority and their revisionist strivings are very timid, the majority, understandably, can limit itself to a dry rejection of these, quote, innovations. But for us Russians, it is the critics and the, quote, economists who stand for the preservation of what exists. The critics, unquote, unquote, want people to consider them still to be Marxists, and to guarantee them their, quote, freedom of criticism, unquote, which they enjoy in every sense of the word, because they basically do not recognize, note 5, any party tie, especially since we have no generally recognized party organ that could, quote, limit their freedom of criticism, even with good advice. The, quote, economists want the revolutionaries to admit, quote, the full rights of the movement now existing, unquote, Rabochi Dielo, number 10, page 25, that is the, quote, legitimacy of the existence of that which exists. They demand that the, quote, ideologues should not try to cause the movement, quote, to stray, unquote, from the path which is, quote, determined by the interaction of material elements and the material environment. Letter in number 12, Iskra. They demand that we acknowledge as desirable the struggle, quote, that is the only possible one for the workers to conduct under the present circumstances, unquote, and that we acknowledge as the only one possible the struggle, quote, that they are actually conducting at the present moment. Separate supplement to Rabochaya Musil, page 14. Now, that note number 5 on they basically do not recognize any party tie. Just by itself, this absence of an open party tie and party traditions constitutes a cardinal difference between Russia and Germany that should warn off any reasonable socialist from blind imitation. And here is a good example of what, quote, freedom of criticism, unquote, leads to in Russia. A Russian, quote, critic, Mr. Bulgakov, made the following rebuke to an Austrian critic, Hertz. For all the independence of his conclusions, Hertz, on this point, on cooperatives, evidently still remains somewhat bound by the opinion of his party, and, while he differs in details, cannot bring himself to break with the common principle, unquote. Capitalism and Agriculture, Volume 2, page 287. Here, we see the subject of a politically enslaved state in which 999 of 1,000 of the population is led astray to the very marrow by political servility and by a complete lack of understanding of party honor and party ties, and he grandly rebukes the citizen of a constitutional state because he is excessively, quote, tied by the opinion of his party. All that remains is for our illegal organizations to start composing resolutions about freedom of criticism. And then you'd lose even that little bit of capacity for resistance to the absolutist state, I think is what he means. So back in the body text, We revolutionary social democrats, on the other hand, are unhappy with this kowtowing to Stakhinost. That is, that which exists, quote, at the present moment. Spontaneity, right? We are the ones demanding changes in the dominant tactic of recent years. We openly state that, quote, before uniting and for the sake of uniting, it is necessary resolutely and firmly to draw lines of demarcation, unquote, taken from the announcement of Iskra's publication. In a word, the Germans stand for the given situation and reject changes. We demand changes in the given situation and strive against kowtowing to this situation and any reconciliation with it. It is this, quote, little difference that our, quote, free copycats of German resolutions have not noticed. D. Engels on the significance of theoretical struggle. Quote, dogmatism, doctrinarism, unquote, quote, ossification of the party, the inevitable punishment for the forcible bottling up of thought, unquote, these are the enemies against which the gallant knights of Rabochi Dielo make battle for the sake of, quote, freedom of criticism, unquote. We are very glad that this issue has been raised and would only propose adding another question. Who are the judges? Lying in front of us are two announcements of literary ventures. One is the, quote, program of Rabochi Dielo, the periodic organ of the Union of Russian Social Democrats, off-print from number one of Rabochi Dielo. The other is announcement of the renewal of the publications of the Emancipation of Labor group. Both are dated from 1899, when the, quote, crisis of Marxism had long been placed on the order of the day. And what do we find? In the first of these productions, you will search in vain for any reference to this phenomenon or any definite exposition of the stand that the new publication intended to take on this issue. There is not a word in this program about theoretical work and its present tasks, nor is there in the supplements to it that were adopted by the Third Congress of the Union in 1901, two Congresses, pages 15 through 18. During all this time, the editors of Rabochi Dielo neglected theoretical issues, although these issues were of absorbing interest to all social democrats all over the world. In contrast, the other announcement, from the Emancipation of Labor group, first of all points to the weakening of interest in theory in recent years, insistently demands, quote, vigilant attention to the theoretical side of the revolutionary movement of the proletariat, unquote, and calls for, quote, a merciless critique of Bernsteinist and other anti-revolutionary tendencies, unquote, in our movement. The issues of Tsardia that have since come out show how this program of action was fulfilled. Thus we see that pompous phrases about the ossification of thought, and so on, conceals lack of concern and lack of ability in the development of theoretical work. The example of Russian social democrats illustrates with particular clarity a pan-European phenomenon, already long noted by German Marxists, that the vaunted freedom of criticism does not mean the substitution of one theory for another, but freedom from any consistent and thoroughly considered theory. It means eclecticism and lack of principle. Anyone who is at all familiar with the actual state of our movement cannot help seeing that the wide dissemination of Marxism was accompanied by a definite lowering of theoretical standards. Thanks to its practical significance and practical successes, the movement attracted quite a few people who had very little and even no theoretical preparation. One can therefore judge the lack of judgment shown by Rabochi Dielo when it promotes with a triumphal flourish Marx's epigram, "Every step of a genuine movement is more important than a dozen programs," unquote. To repeat these words in an era of theoretical disarray is the same as crying, quote, "many happy returns of the day," to a funeral procession. And besides, these words are taken from Marx's letter about the Gotha program, in which he sharply denounces its eclecticism in the formulation of principles. "If it is necessary to merge," wrote Marx to the leaders of the party, "then strike an agreement for the sake of achieving the practical aims of the movement, but don't make deals at the expense of principles. Don't make theoretical, quote, concessions. This is how Marx thought, and yet we find people who try, in his name, to weaken the significance of theory. Without a revolutionary theory, there can be no revolutionary movement. It is impossible to emphasize this thought too much at a time when, along with the fashionable preaching of opportunism, people are carried away with the narrowest possible forms of practical activity. And for Russian social democracy in particular, the significance of theory is intensified by three circumstances that people often forget. First, our party is just now beginning to form, is just now working out its profile, and is still far from settling accounts with other tendencies of revolutionary thought that threaten to cause the movement to stray from the correct path. On the contrary, we see that it is precisely the recent period that has seen a new vitality in non-social democratic revolutionary tendencies, as Axelrod forecast to the, quote, economists long ago. Under these circumstances, a mistake that seems at first to be, quote, unimportant, can have the most unfortunate consequences, so that only myopic people can regard factional disputes and a strict separation of nuances to be premature or superfluous. The whole future of Russian social democracy for many years to come can depend on the relative strength of this or that, quote, nuance. Second, the social democratic movement is international in its very essence. This does not only mean that we must struggle with national chauvinism. It also means that a movement starting up in a young country can be successful only if it assimilates the experience of other countries. And this kind of assimilation requires more than a simple familiarity with this experience or a simple copying of the latest resolutions. It requires the ability to have a critical attitude toward this experience and to verify it independently. I.e. Russia should not just be directly copying Germany. Anyone who takes the trouble to reflect on how enormously the present-day worker movement has grown and developed will realize what a reservoir of theoretical forces and of political as well as revolutionary experience is necessary for the fulfillment of this task. Third, the national tasks of Russian social democracy are unlike those confronted by any other socialist party in the world. Later, we will have occasion to talk about the political and organizational obligations that are assigned to us by the task of liberating the whole people from the yoke of autocracy. Now, we wish only to underline that the role of an advanced fighter can only be fulfilled by a party guided by an advanced theory. And to have some concrete idea of what this means, let the reader recall such forerunners of Russian social democracy as Herzen, Belinsky, Chernyshevsky, and the brilliant galaxy of revolutionaries of the 70s, 1870s. Let him remember the world's significance that Russian literature has now acquired. Let that suffice. We will now quote some remarks of Engels from 1874 on the issue of the significance of theory in the social democratic movement. Engels recognizes not just two forms of the great struggle of social democracy, political and economic, as is customary with us, but three, putting theoretical struggle alongside the other two. His words of advice to the German worker movement, one that was already strong politically and practically, are so educational from the point of view of present-day issues and disputes that the reader will forgive us, we hope, for the long citation from the preface to the pamphlet, The German Peasant War, copies of which have long since become extremely rare. The German workers have two essential advantages compared to the workers in the rest of Europe. The first is that they belong to the most theoretical people of Europe, and that they preserve the sense of theory that has almost completely been squandered by the so-called, quote, educated classes in Germany. Without the German philosophy that preceded it, in particular the philosophy of Hegel, German scientific socialism, the only scientific socialism that has ever existed, would not have been created. Without this sense of theory among the workers, this scientific socialism would never have entered into their flesh and blood to the degree that we see today. And how unimaginably great is this advantage is demonstrated, on the one hand, by the indifference to any theory that constitutes one of the principal reasons why the English worker movement moves forward so slowly, despite its magnificent organization of separate crafts, and on the other hand, it is demonstrated by the confusion and unsteadiness that Proudhonism sowed among the French and the Belgians in its original form, and among the Spanish and the Italians in the caricature form given to it by Bakunin. The second advantage is that the Germans took part in the international worker movement later than almost anybody else. German theoretical socialism will never forget that it stands on the shoulders of Saint-Simon, Fourier, and Owen, three thinkers who, despite all the fantastic utopianism of their teaching, were among the greatest thinkers of all time, and who anticipated with genius an infinite number of those truths whose correctness we have demonstrated scientifically only now. In just the same way, the German practical worker movement should never forget that it developed on the shoulders of the English and French movements, that it enjoyed the possibility of simply taking over for its own use the experience acquired with so much difficulty, and of avoiding those errors today that for the most part were impossible to avoid earlier. Where would we be now without the image of the English trade unioni, right, trade union, and the French political struggle of the workers, without the colossal push forward given in particular by the Paris Commune? It is only fair to the German workers to note that they have used the advantages of their position with rare ability. For the first time since the existence of the worker movement, the struggle is conducted systematically in all three of its aspects that are coordinated and linked among themselves: theoretical, political, and practical economic resistance to the capitalists. In this, so to speak, concentric attack lies the strength and the invincibility of the German movement. As a consequence of this advantageous position on the one hand, and of the insular particularities of the English movement and the violent repression of the French one on the other, the German workers at the present moment are placed at the head of the proletarian struggle. How long events will allow them to occupy this responsible post cannot be predicted, but as long as they do occupy it, one may hope that they will carry out the responsibilities given to them in a fitting way. This requires a doubled intensification of forces in all areas of struggle and agitation. In particular, it is the responsibility of the leaders, Vojdi, to enlighten themselves more and more in theoretical issues, to liberate themselves more and more from the influence of traditional phrases that belong to the old worldview, and to always keep in mind that from the time it became scientific, socialism demands to be treated as a science, that is, that it must be studied. The ever more clear awareness acquired in this way must be disseminated among the worker masses with ever greater zeal. The solidarity of the organization of the party and the organization of the trade unions must be ever more powerfully strengthened. If the German workers will go forward in this way, then they will not so much march at the head of the movement, since it is not at all in the interests of the movement that the workers of any one nation march at its head, but they will occupy a place of honor in the ranks of the fighters, and they will stand ready and armed if unexpectedly heavy tests or great events demand from them even greater courage, even greater resoluteness and energy. Engels' words proved to be prophetic. Within a few years, the German workers did face an unexpectedly heavy test in the form of the exceptional law against socialism. And the German workers indeed stood ready and armed and were able to emerge victoriously from this test. The Russian proletariat faces tests that are incomparably heavier, faces a struggle against a monster in comparison with which the exceptional law in a constitutional country is a mere pygmy. History has put before us an immediate task that is the most revolutionary of all the immediate tasks of any other country. Carrying out this task, the destruction of the most powerful support not only of European but also, we can now say, Asiatic reaction, will make the Russian proletariat the vanguard of the international revolutionary proletariat. and we have the right to assume that we will attain this honorable calling that our predecessors, the revolutionaries of the 70s, already merited, if we know how to inspire our own movement, one that is 1,000 times broader and deeper than the movement of the 1870s, with the same dedicated resoluteness and energy. That's the end of chapter one of What is to be Done by Lenin in the new translation by Lars T. Lee. And that can be found in the book Lenin Rediscovered, What is to be Done in Context. I'm Fergal Schmoodlach, host of The Kingless Generation, which is a podcast on the deep history of class struggle. And this audiobook is provided free of charge, but if you would like to support this project, look us up on Patreon. That's The Kingless Generation,